I'd like to welcome you to the program. This is a special episode of Mostly Folk. It's a program that was recorded at WIOX Community Radio in Roxbury, New York, on my other program, The Catskills Cafe. And the guest on the program is Mike Agronoff. I want to read you a little description from Mike's bio. It says that Mike Agronoff's material encompasses traditional ballads and tunes, Tin Pan Alley, contemporaries in the folk world, heart-stopping spoken pieces, and his own witty pen. It's delivered with skillful guitar and concertina accompaniment, a telepathic transmittal of the essence of the song, and a sly twinkle in the eye for some truly hilarious songs. So we'll begin the program today with a song from Mike's album Ain't Never Been Plugged. Here's Mike Agronoff with The Highway. I'm Artie Martello, and welcome to Mostly Folk.
In a swamp along the highway, tall trees stand bare, stripped of bark, while overhead the herons build their nests. The trees gray light, the nests brown dark. The birds all wheel away in summer. Each nest stands open to the weather, till in the spring, when heron flocks return to raise their families together. This is how the story goes now and then. If you listen, you can hear. We may meet again, who knows where or when, with the turning of the year. We may meet again, who knows where or when, with the turning of the year. Fallow field along the highway, corn stalks scattered on the dirt, last summer's bounty harvested and sown, the cold, cold ground remains inert. Till in spring, when sun shines longer, the earth responds to warm weather. The stalks decay, the plowman makes his way, mixing the stalks and soil together. This is how the story goes now and then. If you listen, you can hear. We may meet again, who knows where or when, with the turning of the year. We may meet again, who knows where or when, with the turning of the year. Cycle of seasons, tempest and time, effects of planetary motion around the sun. The bluest blue moon still tugs the tide around the ocean. Drivers all along the highway, mostly on their way to work, they're weaving in and out across the lanes, this one polite, that one a jerk. Most like me work in some building, completely cut off from the weather. And at day's end, we barrel round the bend, all homeward bound, alone, together. This is how the story goes now and then. If you listen, you can hear. We may meet again, who knows where or when, with the turning of the year. We may meet again, who knows where or when, with the turning of the year.
Once again, from his album Ain't Never Been Plugged, that's Mike Agranoff with The Highway. Now I'm going to jump right into the interview on WIOX, and I'm so happy I could bring this to you. I started off by asking Mike to talk a little bit about his background.
Well, I guess I got into this thing, I took classical piano lessons when I was 10 years old. But pianos were too big to bring to parties. So I bought a guitar just at the peak of the great folk scare of the 60s, and it's you know, it's a socially acceptable way of saying, "Hey, look at me!" You know, I mean, I'm honest about myself. Yeah. It's I've got an ego.
Julie Gold had that same problem. She couldn't bring her piano with her wherever she went. So, you know, she had to make sure that the venue had a piano because that's all she plays.
Well, so, until they
luckily, can't. You play a lot more than that, so.
I do play. I do play piano, but I haven't performed on piano in several years now. Mm-hmm. Again, it's such a small part of my repertoire that it's not worth toting around a keyboard and then to be relying on whatever they've got at the venue is sometimes a crapshoot. So I've pretty much dropped the piano from my performing repertoire. At least I play concertina, which I am not going to do today because my concertina is at the concertina doctor.
Disappointed because I was really looking forward to you playing the concertina.
Well, you can play one of the tracks with concertina.
Yeah, well, we do have some yeah. tracks that we planned ahead of time, so
Just me and the guitar today.
Well, that's okay. You know, that's good enough, really. Talk about yourself. Where did you grow up?
Grew up in New York City.
Oh, did you? You did? I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Way upper Manhattan. Looked out of the window of my apartment up at the Tower of the Cloisters.
Oh, really?
All the way up by Fort Tryon Park. And then I moved to New Jersey in something like 1970, and I've been in my home in Booton Township since 1980. I got into folk music pretty much through the Crosby, Stills, Mitchell, and Garfunkel repertoire that was popular when I was in my teens, and discovered the folk scene. When I was in New Jersey, I heard about this organization called the Folk Music Society of Northern New Jersey, and they were going to be putting on a Don McLean concert, but I had a ski trip scheduled for that weekend, but I looked them up, and that introduced me into the sort of more esoteric world, a world of traditional and acoustic folk, as opposed to the folk pop that was on the radio at the time, or I should say in addition to the folk pop that was on the radio at the time. And then that's sort of been my focus ever since. I do traditional music, I do contemporary music, I do a little of my own, I do spoken word stuff. I'm more of a singer-song finder than a singer-song writer, although I have written a few songs.
You grew up in New York. Where did you go to school?
The public school system, for elementary and junior high, I went to Bronx High School of Science, And then I actually lived at home during my college years, traveling by subway down to the Polytechnic Institute of Brooklyn, where I got my BSME and then later MSME, Masters of Mechanical Engineering. And that was my primary source of income as a mechanical engineer for all of my life. Music was a very important sideline. Because just about all of my social life revolved around it, and I've been gigging out on weekends, between workday job since the late 70s. And there's more than one reason why not only did I find that engineering was a more practical way of paying the mortgage than folk music, I also loved the job. I never worked a day in my life. I was, it's Monday, it's time to go in and solve puzzles. Yay!
That's so great. But why did you leave it? Why did you leave that job?
It left me. They laid me off in the downturn after 2008. And by which time I was pushing 70, it was pretty hard to get a job at that age. And financially, I was, I never had a family, so there were no college education or braces to pay for. And my hobby made me money, so I was just socking it away. The place I worked for most of my career was always in financial difficulties. They were, on credit hold with suppliers, and they paid me half what I was worth and twice what I needed, and everybody was happy.
Wow. So you moved out of that, and did you go directly into playing out, or were you doing that while you were still?
I've been playing out since the 70s. So okay. My very first gig was at a high school coffee house run by, what's her name? She's still around. Her name escapes me, and it may pop up into my memory later. But she's still very much involved in the folk scene as an agent, and as a, it'll come.
Uh-huh. And she guided you, or
no? She just booked me.
Okay.
but I've run across her from time to time at conferences and stuff like that ever since.
All right. So where did you? What kind of clubs do you play?
And mostly folk music concert series. Usually the ones that are nonprofit, run in church buildings or what have you, by folk music societies, places like the Folk Project here in New Jersey. I just did a gig for Passim, Club Passim in Cambridge, which is one of the legacy clubs. I've played the Philadelphia Folk Festival. I've played a bunch of other major festivals.
Yeah. You have, how many albums do you have now?
Four.
Four albums. What would you like to do? Would you like to play live, or should we play some stuff from the album?
I'll play you some. This is an old tune from the 40s, a big band tune. And I learned it a while ago to sort of make a snappy guitar arrangement out of it. But I wanted to do it upright, so I wanted to learn what they call the verse, what a lot of people would call the introduction, the slow part that comes before the main part of the up-tempo part of the tune that everybody knows. So I went and bought the sheet music, which will go show you how long ago I learned this thing. and it didn't have an introduction. So I wrote one. So let's see if you can figure out what the tune is before the tune comes around. I'm sitting in the station, I've got my reservation. New York, you have seen the last of me. In the waiting room I stand, my ticket's in my hand. I'm trying to get back home to Tennessee. But the Pennsylvania station is a big confusing place, and I've been searching for my platform long in vain. Oh, but here's a local fellow with a friendly, smiling face. Perhaps he'll tell me how to find my train. Got it? But we have to update it just a tad. Pardon me, sir. Is this the Chattanooga choo-choo? Track 29. Oh, you can give me a shine. Well, I can afford for the Chattanooga choo-choo. And I've got my fare, just a trifle to spare. You leave the Pennsylvania station about quarter to four. Read a magazine and grin both some more. Dinner in the diner, nothing could be finer than to have your ham and eggs in Carolina. When you hear the whistle blow into the bar, then you know the Tennessee is not very far. Shovel all the coal in, gotta keep it rolling. Woo-hoo! Chattanooga, there you are. Oh, there's gonna be a certain party at the station. I used to call funny things. Well, I think I'll tell you. Water fella that'll never roll. No, 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 Chattanooga choo-choo. Come on and choo-choo me home.
Yes, yes. Love it. I love it. It kind of reminded me of your song 60s Mudley, which I absolutely love. Maybe you could do it. If not, we'll play it later. You know, you were talking about the sitting at the railway station. I thought it was going to be a Simon and Garfunkel thing.
Oh, no.
But that was great. By the way, where did you learn to play guitar? That was so nice.
I taught myself.
Get away.
I taught myself. I took classical piano lessons, so at least I knew music theory. And so I then knew chord theory and was able to say, you know, to hear a relatively simple song and know what chords go with it. So it was just a matter of getting the book and seeing where the finger position was. And oddly enough, when I first started to play, you know, it was put this finger here and this finger here and this finger here. But the right hand just automatically went. I'm in the wrong tuning. No wonder it sounds. I mean, the right hand just came automatically like this. So who knows? I never learned how to play with a flat pick. It was always clumsy with me, and I actually started to take some lessons much later in the early aughts to learn jazz chords, and I found that this kind of action with my hand gave me bursitis.
Really?
Doc, it hurts when I do this. Don't do that. So I don't play with a flat pick.
Now, you didn't follow a certain type of picking, like Travis picking or something to that effect, or you just started doing it naturally?
Yeah, that was a fairly natural thing for my right hand to do, maybe because I had piano experience, I don't know. Huh. That's what seemed to work.
I'm here with Mike Agronoff. You're listening to the Catskills Cafe. I'm Odie Martello. And Mike, by the way, his website is mikeagronoff.com. I love your website.
Thank you.
Who does the website? Do you do it yourself?
Well, it was constructed originally by a friend of mine from New Jersey. But it's since been, I've added to it. I'm do most of the updates on it myself, but if I have to do something special, I've got a web designer that I turn to who can do it for real. So I'm have very, you know, elementary knowledge of HTML and what have you, but most of the time I just work through Dreamweaver.
When you go into the website, it's sort of a little fun experience. It isn't just go right into Mike's website. So I won't say anything about it for folks that haven't been there. MikeAgronoff.com is the website. And once again,
I'll spell that because it's not immediately
obvious. Okay, yeah, spell
it
out.
Mike. It's Mike Agronoff. A lot of people mix up the last A and O.
Okay. So there you go. And take a look, and you will like it, I'm sure.
I once saw a whale with a golden tooth. And he riz right out of the sea and opened his mouth in the morning sun and showed that tooth to me. And once I was fishing the deep ground with nigh 6 pound of lead, and I caught me a cod as big as a man, and it had a man's head. Ain't no end to what I'd tell once I was well begun. Like seeing the devil rise out of the sea instead of the morning sun, and sea snakes lashing the moonlit waves with their terrible lullapins, and little mermaids with diamond eyes and solid silver fins. Some have eyes to see strange sights, and such a one I be, but then I ain't known as a truthful man, and nobody harks to me. There's a fisherman sitting alone on the land. His hands are his craft, his boat is his art. A fisherman sitting alone on the land, a rock, a hard rock in his heart. And there's a silky maid swimming alone in the bay. Her eyes are the seals, her heart is the sea. A silky maid swimming alone in the bay, and a pure white seal maiden is she. And she comes on the shore and she sheds her seal skin. She dances on sand, dances under the moon. Her hair falls in waves down upon her white skin. and only the seals hear the tune. Then standing, the fisherman takes her seal skin, staking his claim to a wife from the sea. He raises his hand, holding up the white skin, saying, "Now you must come home with me." Oh, weeping she goes, and still weeping she stays. Her hands are her craft, her babes are her art. A year and a year and a year more she stays, a rock, a cold rock in her heart. Ah, but what is this hid in the fisherman's bag? It smells like the ocean. It feels like the sea. It's a bunny white seal skin closed up in the bag. Oh, and never a tear more, cries she. Goodbye to the house and goodbye to the shore. Goodbye to the babes that I never could claim. Ah, but never a thought for the man left on shore, for silky's my nature and name. She puts on the skin and dives back in the sea. The fisherman's cry falls on water-deaf ears. She swims in her seal skin away out to sea, and the fisherman drowns in his tears. Dear wife, well met, my blue-eyed lady. How strange to see thee at my gate, how strange to see thy baby. Thy dark-eyed crying baby. Come in, my own dear wife. Come in out of the rain, oh, come dry thy feet and warm thy hands all by my fire again, oh, all in my hall again, oh. Call for the cook to bring thee meat, the maid to bring thee wine, oh, and for also the suckling thy babe that he might dine, oh, thy hungry babe might dine, oh. Where is thy gown of silk so fine, thy boots of Spanish leather? And where is the gypsy Davy now, since you rode off together? Rode hand in hand together. Bed. Thou left thy husband and baby, oh, to lie on the cold, cold ground in the arms of the gypsy Davy, the handsome gypsy Davy. And out next with thee, my best grey mare, to ride when thou didst pardon. And thou took'st with thee my silver and gold, and took as well my heart, oh, forever took my heart, oh. I could forgive my best grey mare, of gold I have great store, oh, but my heart I gave but once away, and I cannot give it more, oh, which grieves me 10 times more, oh. Come greet thy new half-brother, come wish them well before they go, and leave this hall forever, and bid farewell forever.
Couple of songs from the album Or Would You Rather Get a Job. We first heard the Ballad of the White Seal Maid and followed up by Gypsy Davy 1 year after. I asked Mike to talk about these two songs.
The that first one is quite a collaboration of people who didn't collaborate. The opening poem was by a woman named Ruth Moore. She's no longer with us. She's from Maine, wrote some interesting little book of poems called Cold as a Dog in the Wind Nah East. And then the song was also a remarkable collaboration. It was written, the lyrics were originally a poem written by Jane Yolen, who is a children and science fiction writer. It was set to music by Louis Collins, who sings it unaccompanied, and then I added first the guitar part to it, which is how I perform it live, and then the big monster. The concertina part. Yeah. I added the concertina part to it. That's the concertina that's now in at the repair shop. And the second one, the Gypsy Davy 1 year after, while it sounds like a traditional ballad, actually is one of the few songs that I've written. And I wrote that originally to be sung a cappella, as in a traditional ballad, but then I added the guitar part, which is how I perform it live. And then for the recording, a local band called Broadside Electric, that specialized in doing traditional music, in full rock and roll mode, like a la Fairport Convention, they helped come up with the arrangement that we did for that. That song, by the way, I don't know how many folks are into traditional English folk music, but it is actually a sequel to a traditional ballad called Gypsy Davy, the Whistling Gypsy Rover, Blackjack Davy. There are a bazillion different versions of it on both sides of the Atlantic. And I think the plot of the original is fairly well implied by mine, where, you know, the handsome gypsy wanders up to the manor and spirits away the lovely young wife of the lord, and when he comes home, chases after them and says, and I actually quoted some of the lines of the tradition, "Would you leave your house and home? Would you leave your baby?" Blah blah blah. She essentially says, "Yep," and leaves him to go home with what dignity he has. And I've always been troubled by that ballad for a couple of reasons. One, what is a high-born woman gonna do on the road with a band of gypsies? She doesn't know how to shoe the horses or tell the fortunes or steal the, pick the pockets or anything like that. She's going to be a burden on the tribe. There's going to be resentment built up between her and the rest of the tribe. And no matter who leaves whom, the marriage isn't going to last 3 months, and she's going to be pregnant. And that's a problem, because there isn't any support system for unwed mothers in 16, whatever the heck year this is supposed to take place in. And she's out there in the woods with a newborn, starving. So I said to myself, what would she do? There's only one place she can go where there's any possibility of help, and that's back home. And can you imagine the humiliation of showing up so many months later at your husband's door with another man's child in your arms? Oh, and that's where I started it. Huh. And I said, what would she do?
What 1 year after.
And I wrote a verse. And I said, well, what would happen after that? And I wrote another verse. And I didn't know how the story was going to end.
Interesting.
I was frantically writing this song to find out how the story ends. It was a very strange process. And I came to that one line, but my heart I gave but once away, and I cannot give it morrow. And that informed me of the answer. He still loves her desperately, and he cannot take her back. He has to send her back out into the wilderness with the child to starve to death. And it's particularly sad because I'm virtually certain that Mike Agronoff would have taken her back.
Wow, that's an interesting story. I never realized.
Yeah.
I never even thought of that, or, you know, kind of introspective.
It was a very strange thought process.
Yeah, really. Well, I'm glad you did it. Certainly it's something that, how many songs have you written?
I've written two, really, that I perform. I've written a number of parodies, and I've written a whole bunch of spoken word stuff, which we'll get to eventually. As a matter of fact, I have just released a month ago a brand new book of recitations. Hang on. It's called Jake the Captain and Other Heroes.
Tell me about the book, Mike.
It's a collection of the recitations that I've wrote. There are about half a dozen in there. We'll get to some of them. But I learned fairly early about spoken word being a viable entertainment format. And I learned that from a pair of traditional English singers, John Roberts and Tony Barons. John and Tony are two Englishmen who moved into, I don't know if they're citizens or legal or resident aliens, but they've been living in this country since the 60s. They met at Cornell, both of them interested in traditional music, and they found that they both sang very well, and they sang very well together, and they formed a long-standing duet that pretty much defined traditional English song for an entire generation of American folkies. But one of the things that they did in addition to songs is these recitations, these spoken word narrative poems, some of them funny, some of them serious, that were legitimate stage fare at the turn of the 20th century, both in American vaudeville and in English music hall at the time. And there were very famous entertainers at the time who that was their thing. And I learned from Tony Barons, who did one of the more well-known ones from the English music hall, The Battle of Hastings, that this is a legitimate and entertaining form of performance. And so first I learned other people's, and then I started writing my own. And they're kind of a hallmark of my performance. I generally do at least one per show.
You have on, what album is it? Ain't Never Been Plugged. As I mentioned before, you talk about some of the things. Well, this is definitely a song you wrote because it's not out there. Nobody's ever sang this song aside from Mike Agronoff. But it's one of my favorite tunes, and I've played it quite often on my various radio programs. And that is the 60s Mudley. We mentioned that briefly. Oh, look at that cute little cat.
I could do that if I can remember the words.
Great.
I'm getting old. It's hard to remember.
No, that's all right.
Let me see if I can do this now.
I'm glad you can do it. I have the recording if you forgot the words, but
no, I want to give it a shot. Let's see, how did it begin? Wait a minute. I got it. Yeah. I think, yeah. Busted flat in Baton Rouge, West Virginia, with a dollar in my hand. I'm sitting in the railway station, waiting for a train. I ain't sleepy and there ain't no place I'm going to. Take me home where the thoughts are straying, home where the deer and the antelope play. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. Where I'm bound, I can't tell. And the good times are all gone, so I'll follow the sun. And as I look around me at the four gray walls that surround me, well, already I'm so lonesome I could die. I've looked at love from both sides now, seen sunny days a thought would never end. If I was a carpenter, I'd hammer in the morning. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind and rocked by a sweet baby day. I don't know, something like that.
I think that's
how it goes.
I guess that you enjoy writing songs like this.
I do write parodies, and I like funny songs. I do a lot of funny songs. Got some favorite people for that. The Berrymans.
You know, of course, in this crazy year that we've all gone through and are still going through, it's a difficult situation for folk musicians to earn a living. How are you faring during this?
I'm fine because I never relied on this for a living. As I said, I was a professional without a family, and I've been just socking it away. And I'm financially fine.
Okay, great.
I could have retired 10 years before I was laid off. Financially.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. But do you do anything like perform?
I've done a couple of online concerts. Okay. I did, as I said, I did one for Club Passim a couple of weeks ago. I also did one for the Folk Project. I did one for the New England Folk Festival, and I'm going to do another one for the New England Folk Festival in April. And as of now, that's the only sort of official paying gigs that I've got lined up. And I, you know, have a couple of Zoom song slops that I attend just for fun. One of them is interesting. It's a transatlantic song slop between England and the U.S. It's on Monday nights at 8 o'clock their time, 3 o'clock our time. Some very interesting people, and the repertoire of the English Folk Club, which is somewhat different. The whole milieu is the folk scene in the UK is different from us. They're mm-hmm. mostly centered in pubs, and they're mostly done in they revolve around groups of people who meet weekly in the function room of a pub to sing, not as a performance, but to sing as a social activity. So they get a couple of pints, and they take turns singing. Most of them have songs with choruses that people can join in on, which is why a lot of those English songs are all chorus oriented. So it's a different feel. And then some of the folk clubs, they're generally done on weeknights, and some of them will have a guest singer once a month, in addition, in place of their regular. And so that's where the touring professionals go to perform. It's usually, unlike in this country where you pretty much everything's confined to the weekends, in the UK you can travel a reasonable distance and do a gig every night at these, and they're not obviously, because they have smaller audiences, they don't make as much money per gig, but you're doing it, but you're working, you know, 5-6 nights a week.
So is this something that people can go to watch?
Yes, yes. It's,
how does it work?
Well, it's sort of not publicized.
Okay.
It's called the Transatlantic Zing, as in sing with a Z.
Okay.
If somebody is interested in checking it out, why don't you contact Artie, and he'll forward your inquiry to me. It's easier than me giving you my address, which you'll have to remember.
Okay. Cool. Great. As far as when you do something, do you post on your website any upcoming performances that
I do.
You are involved in?
I do. It's on the gigs page of my website. And I do have a couple of house concerts lined up, one in July and then a bunch of them in October and November. And all of those, of course, are provisional, depending upon the circumstances. But at least they're down in some people's calendars.
Right. While we're talking about it, tell people about house concerts, because a lot of people don't really know about house concerts. You know, they think that concerts are just relegated to folk clubs or some kind of a venue that would, allow a performer to perform. But house concerts are quite popular, especially in this community. So just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's actually, there are quite a lot of them scattered all over the country, and they're run by fans of the music and of the musicians. And it is exactly what it sounds like, a concert in somebody's home. It's not a party. It's not although there may be a party afterwards. Mm-hmm. It is a concert, often done without any sound system. And it's, you know, audiences anywhere from 15 to 40, some of them more. And it's the most intimate way of hearing a performer, because there's often interplay between the audience and the performer, which is feels much more comfortable in the situation of a living room than in a concert hall where there's a stage. And I love them. I like them a lot.
I think it's such a great concept. I often wonder, I've often thought, gee, I would love to have a house concert, but I don't know if I can get enough people to come. And, you know, so I don't know how you get around that, but, you know, you still have to guarantee the artist something.
For people with small houses, you maybe do it outdoors in the summer. That's one way. But people with enormous, you can get 15 people in a decent sized living room. You know, people rearrange the furniture. They take the big easy chairs and couches and shove them up against the wall, and they put up folding seats and a couple of lights, and that's all you need. There is an organization called Listening Room Network that serves as a kind of a yenta, a matchmaking organization between hosts and performers.
Oh, that's good.
That's nationwide. If you go Listening Room Network, I don't remember if it's .com or .org at the moment, but
Google it. You'll find out.
Yeah. And they've got a very nice little primer for both artists and hosts on how to take advantage of this, how to host a house concert, and how to deal with performing in house concerts, depending upon who the target is.
Well, let's play a tune from your album, your last album, Straight Lines, and this is a song called Iowa Pot, and it's an interesting title.
Yeah, leave the camera on. I want to watch your face.
Okay.
Oh, Iowa lot to Iowa pot, Iowa born and bred. I never knew such beautiful boo grew in this groovy land I'm in, and I'm indebted indeed to Iowa weed. Iowa bred and born, oh, Iowa lot to Iowa pot. And it's not just Iowa corn. Contraband from the land of manana is so ruthlessly risky to cop. But them Iowans cop when they wanna, standing on a marijuana crop, and it grows in that Midwestern section, and there isn't a glimmer of doubt it would shake a Jamaica connection, 'cause it's cheap, deep, and far fleeping out. Oh, Iowa lot to Iowa pot, Iowa born and bred. I never knew such beautiful boo grew in this groovy land I'm in, and I'm indebted indeed to Iowa weed. Iowa bred and born, oh, Iowa lot to Iowa pot. And it's not just Iowa corn. Now, I never cared much for domestic, I would always be turning it down. But I just smoked a joint so majestic, so fantastic, it's the best stick in town. You can keep your Columbia ripoff and your shady Canadian scene, for I'd rather be singeing my lip off on some neat, sweet, Iowa green. Oh, Iowa lot to Iowa pot, Iowa born and bred. I never knew such beautiful boo grew in this groovy land I'm in, and I'm indebted indeed to Iowa weed, Iowa bred and born, oh, Iowa lot to Iowa pot. And it's not just Iowa corn, no, it's not just Iowa corn.
I love it. And I was just reading the liner notes that you did this with Gathering Time.
Yeah.
Stuart Marcus, Hillary Fox song, and Jerry McKeveny. So that was lots of fun.
Well, I heard this song for the first time in the campgrounds of the Philadelphia Folk Festival, and what more appropriate place would there be to hear that song? and I said, this is a song that's got to be done barbershop. For decades, I was looking for a quartet that I could put together to begin it. And then finally, since I'm good pals with Gathering Times, and we've done a number of split bills with each other. Mm-hmm. So this was one that was appropriate for us.
And that song was written by Jerry Samuels.
Yeah, who is AKA Napoleon the 14th, who also wrote They're Coming to Take Me Away, Ha Ha.
Oh, really? Oh, my gosh. Oh, that's
he was a regular, you know, Music City songwriter for the during the 50s and 60s.
That is so cool. Anyway,
this, by the way, would lead to a spoken word piece, one that I did not write. This is written by Shel Silverstein, and I will dedicate it to New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, who was working like Dickens to pass legal recreational marijuana for adults in New Jersey.
And what is the Shel Silverstein song?
I'm about to do it.
Oh, good. Okay.
In the laid-back California town of sunny San Rafael lives a girl named Pearly Sweetcake. You probably know her well. She'd been stoned 15 of her 18 years. And the tale was widely told how she could smoke them faster than anyone could roll. Now her legend finally reached New York in that walk-up Grove Street flat where dwelt the Calistoga Kid, a beatnik from way back. With long brown lightning fingers, he takes a cultured toke, says, "Hell, I can roll a faster man than any chick could smoke." So word gets sent to San Rafael. For the championship of the world, the kid demands a smoke off. "Ah, bring him on," says Pearl. "I'll grind his fingers off his hands. He'll roll until he drops," says Calistoga. "I'll smoke that twist," and she blows up and pops. So they rent out Yankee Stadium. And the word is quickly spread. Come one, come all, who walk, who crawl, price just two lids ahead. And from every town and hamlet, by land and sea they speed, the world's greatest dopers with the world's greatest weed. Hashishers from Morocco, hemp smokers from Peru, and shamniks from Bagoon who puff the deadly poogaroo. And those who call it light of life, and those who call it boo. So, see the dealers and their ladies dressed in turquoise, lace, and leather. See the narcos in the closet, pokers puffing all together. From the teenies who smoke legal to the ones who've done some time, to the old man who smoked reefer back before it was a crime. And that grand old house that Ruth built is filled with smoke and cries of 50,000 screaming heads all stoned out of their minds. And they play the national anthem, and the crowd lets out a roar, and the spotlight hits the kid and Pearl, ready for their smoking war. And on a table, piled with grass, an Everest of weed, just the tops and buds of the rarest flowers, not one stick, stem, or seed. Maui Wowie, Panama Red, Acapulco gold, keef from East Afghanistan and rare Alaskan cold, sticks from Thailand, ganja from the islands, Bangkok's blooming best and some of that wet imported stuff that capsized off Key West. Waxican tops, Kenya Bang, Riviera Fleurs, and that fine Manhattan silver that grows down New York sewers. Oh, and there's ice cold bubbling lemonade and sweet grapes by the bunches and Hershey bars and Oreos in case anyone gets the munchies. And the Calistoga kid, he sneers, and Pearlie, she just grins. And the drums roll low, and the crowd yells, go! And the great smoke-off begins. Kid flicks his magic fingers once, first joints rolled. Pearl takes one hit with her mighty lungs, the roach is cold. Kid rolls up his super bomb that had paralyzed a moose, and Pearl takes one super hit, and the bomb's diffused. Kid rolls up three in 10 seconds flat. She smokes him down in nine. And everyone sits back, says, this just could take some time. So see the blur of flying fingers, see the red coal burning bright as the evening turns to morning, and the morning fades to night, and the summer goes to autumn. And a whole damn year is gone, but the two still sit on that roach-filled stage just a rolling and a smoking on. With trembling hands, he rolls his J's. With fingers blue and stiff, she coughs and stares with bloodshot gaze and puffs with blistered lips. And as she reaches out her hand for one more stick of cold, the kitty gasps, God damn it, bitch, there's nothing left to roll. Nothing left to roll, screams Pearl. Is this some twisted joke? I didn't come here to around. I come here to smoke. So she reaches out her fingers and grabs his bony sleeves and crumbles in between her hands like dried and brittle leaves, flicking out the teeth and bones like useless stems and seeds. And she rolls him in a zigzag and takes a mighty toke. And the fastest man with the fastest hands goes up in a puff of smoke. In the laid-back California town of sunny San Rafael lives a girl named Pearlie Sweetcake. You probably know her well. She's been stoned 21 of her 24 years. And the tale is widely told how she still could smoke them faster than anyone can roll. While back in New York City, on a street that has no name, there's the bones of the Calistoga Kid in the Vipers Hall of Fame. And underneath the fingers on a little golden scroll, it says, beware of being the roller when there's nothing left to roll.
All right. I don't know how you can remember these things.
I've got all the words tattooed on the inside of my eyelids. Oh, that was the very first recitation that I ever did on stage.
What's the name of that?
The Great Smoke. No, it's The Smoke Off. And I learned it was in the February 1978 issue of Playboy magazine.
I just find, you know, you talk about how you're getting old and forgetting things. I find it remarkable that you could remember such a lengthy poem.
You were talking about memorizing things. I do have a good memory, but it is a learnable skill. And I actually have given workshops on techniques of memorizing songs. You come right down to it, that the smoke off is about 6 minutes. That's about the length of a normal song and a half. So it's not that all that much to memorize. The fact that there are rhymes help it. You know, it kind of predicts what the next line is going to
be. It kind of reminded me a little of Casey at the Bat, you know.
Well, that is the classic recitation that at least people of my generation learned in school and were asked to memorize it, and they did. That used to be a much more practiced skill in society. It used to be a form of home entertainment where people would do it, you know, at parties for each other. I keep looking off camera. I'm sorry. But it is a learnable skill.
Well, in my school, I had to memorize things like the Apostles' Creed and the Our Father and the Hail Mary. Those were all things that we had to memorize for sure. I remember as a kid.
And there's one that just about everybody, although they haven't said it in decades, knows. I pledge allegiance You can finish it. You don't need me.
Well, of course, we're both old enough to know when the Pledge of Allegiance didn't have "Under God" in it. And, you know, that was added later on. I don't know why. I still don't get it, but...
I was pretty young when that change was made. I don't think I was more than about 6 or 7.
No, well, I don't know how old I was. I'm 77 now, so... I always knew the Pledge of Allegiance without the "Under God" thing. It took me a while to get that, and I still get chills when I have to say it, if I have to say it, but I don't have to say it that often, thankfully. Thank God. In any event. So I'm here with Mike Agronoff. Why don't we play something?
Let's play. When free men shall stand between their loved homes and the war's desolation, blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven-rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must when our cause it is just. And this be our motto, in God is our trust. And the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. You didn't know there were four verses
of
the star-spangled banner, did you?
I didn't know that verse.
That's the fourth.
Oh, gosh. Anyway, let's see what I've got here. I've got so many songs here that are lined up. How about we play a song from Ain't Never Been Plugged? And, this is Wayfaring Stranger, which is not an unfamiliar song to a lot of people, but of course Mike Agronoff is doing it. So let me run over to this computer here and start the tune. Here's Mike Agronoff from Ain't Never Been Plugged with Wayfaring.
The way that's said is Ain't Never Been Plugged.
Ain't Never Been Plugged, yes.
Yeah, with a "been" underlined. I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world of woe. And there's no sickness, no toil or danger in that bright world to which I go. I'm going there to see my father. I'm going there no more to roam. I'm only going over Jordan. I'm only going over home. I know dark clouds will gather o'er me. I know the way is long and steep, but peaches fields rise just before me, where souls redeem their vigils keep. I'm going there to see my mother. She said she'd meet me. I'm only going
wear that crown of glory when I get to that promised land. I want to sing salvation's story in concert with that blood-washed band. I'm going there to see my Savior, to sing his praises evermore. I'm only going over Jordan, I'm only going over home.
There you have it, Wayfair and Stranger, and that was Jay Unger and Molly Mason playing with Mike. Wayfair and Stranger, and that one is, what album is that on?
That's from Ain't Never Been Plugged.
Okay. Once again, I'm speaking with Mike Agranoff, and I asked Mike to talk about the Ballad of the Sandman. It's quite a story, and here's Mike.
Okay. Well, the recitation involves the radio from the period of just toward the end of the 60s, when FM first became commercial. It was in the 50s, and it was used mostly in the classical music stations because so many of the benefits of FM applied more to classical than rock. The better fidelity, the stereo, the greater dynamic range. But all the radio stations knew that it was the coming thing. They all got FM broadcast equipment. But at the time, there were not all that many broadcast receivers out in the world to listen to it. So there was no advertising money to be made because there wasn't an audience. So they, in order to fill up the airwaves, because the FCC said you can't broadcast the same programming on AM and FM, they hired DJs to fill up the airwaves, and they didn't really care much what they played. And some of these people were musicologists, had great taste, diverse taste, and it ushered in that wonderful era of freeform radio that could be pretty dreadful in some hands, but in some hands it was just fascinating. And this is kind of that, and the progressive rock was what I grew up on. And the story of Sandman will reveal itself when I do it. But at that time period, one of my favorite DJ, and anyone in the New York City area will recognize the name of Pete Fortitan. He was on WNEW, and he was one of those musically knowledgeable and well-spoken and intelligent people. And when he talked, it didn't sound like none of this, hey, Brother Brucey type of thing. It was just like as an intelligent guy talking right to me, not to the great masses, but to me. And so he was my favorite DJ. So it was quite a surprise to me in, I think 88 or 89, something like that, 1988 or 89. It was a Sunday afternoon, and I'm hanging around doing housework, vacuuming, and the phone rings. I pick up the phone, and it's a friend of mine saying, turn on WNAW, you're on WNAW, turn on. I said, just turn it on. So I turn it on, and there is my voice coming out of the radio doing Ballad of the Sandman. Now, this is remarkable for a couple of reasons. Number one, the show that it's being played on is Pete Portatel's Mixed Bag. And Pete was one of the models for my character, Paul Sandman, in the recitation. And here is my hero DJ playing me. And the second reason why this is remarkable is that I had not yet recorded it at this point. What? There with my jaw hanging around my knees, and it comes to the end, and Pete says, that was singer-songwriter Mike Agronoff doing Ballad of the Sandman, the most impressive piece of literature about the radio business I have ever heard in my life. And I'm going, call up the radio station. It's Sunday. There's no one on the switchboard. I leave a message. He's going to call. Monday night, he calls me. I'm so glad that I happened to hear the show. This is of course pre-internet. He doesn't have he can't Google me to find out who I am or where I am. It was just all I knew. So where does this recording come from? And he told me this series of serendipitous circumstance that you wouldn't believe it if somebody made it up. About 3 weeks or 4 weeks prior to that, I had been a guest on the Gene Shea Show on WXPN in Philadelphia. Gene is was a well-known folk mm-hmm. music DJ. Mm-hmm. So he had me as a live guest to do some songs and to play music. And I also did Sandman because it's a radio show, as it makes sense. It so happened that on the same night, Christine Lavin was in Philadelphia doing a concert. She was a big fan of Gene Shea's and she wanted to hear the show, but she was going to be actually on stage at the time. So she set her cassette recorder on a timer to listen to the Gene Shea show and then listen to the tape on the way back on driving home to New York. And she heard Sandman and said, my buddy, Pete Fortitale, has got to hear this. So she duplicated the cassette, sent it to Pete in the mail. Pete listened to it. He flipped and put this third generation lo-fi cassette recording of a spoken piece on the air on the biggest rock station in New York City.
Amazing.
And so we arranged, he had me come down to the studios in New York to do an interview and to do a much better quality recording of Sandman. And he played that interview and presentation of the piece on his show right before New Year's Eve of that year. When I do the actual piece, you'll see why that is significant. And then following that, he played Sandman on his Mixed Bag show before New Year's Eve every year from that point until the day he died in 2012.
Wow.
He also invited me to do one of his Hunger Year shows, World Hunger Year shows in Beacon Theater, and to play on the 25th anniversary of the Mixed Bag show. So shall we do Sandman?
Yes, sirree. We're ready for it.
Okay. Ballad of the Sandman. When the broadcast room's a living tomb of cracked acoustic tiles, and you're left alone with your microphone and your playlist and your dials, and the hands upon the studio clock pass midnight and creep towards one, it's time to take the air once more, and the graveyard shift's begun. The day shift and the engineers have all left hours ago. You close the heavy soundproof doors, set your board aglow, cue the first two records up, settle in your chair, uncap and snap the transmit switch, and you're on the air. There's magic in the radio, enchantment in the ether, a power born of mind and brain and yet a part of neither. A power to be reckoned not in kilowatts or joules, J-O-U-L-E-S, a means to let a single voice touch 500,000 souls. But when you work that graveyard shift from 1 a.m. to 5, you start to doubt that anyone's out there or alive. The halls are lifeless. The phone is dead. And there's nothing quite so lonely as to call with kilowatts in reply here. Silence only. They usually stick the rookie jocks in a lonely graveyard slot, but me, I broadcast nights by choice. I like that shift a lot. Because when I get the lonelies, as I do from time to time, I recall the Sandman's final show of 1969. 1960s radio was awful at its best. I grew up with Cousin Brucey and the Wolfman and the rest, and between the fast talk and the hype and the Acme lotion jangle and station breaks with sound effects, they'd maybe play a single. But that was all there was back then, and that was all we had. And nostalgia finds a way to sift the good from all the bad. And so intertwined with radio was fond scenes of my youth that it's tinted with a rosy glow that overlays the truth. And I recall all those parties at the beach and every high school date, those midnight drives in my dad's old studying till late. They're all movies in my memory. And behind them, I still hear the Beach Boys and the Beatles and the Motown, oh, so clear to the counterpoint of DJ hype and ads for Wrangle beer. But then in 67, FM burst upon the scene. What once played only Bach and Brahms became a rock fan's dream. Between the sparse commercials, they played three songs in a row, album cuts and full-length versions played in stereo, and gone was all that mile-a-minute brainless DJ chatter and singing station breaks and other oral fecal matter. Instead, these guys with wit and charm told what they had to tell and spoke as if they thought that I might have some brains as well. I got to know them all by voice that summer. And come fall, I'd hung around the station and came to know them all. Bill Clancy in the morning slot, Aunt Stacy, Charlie West, and the Sandman. Now, he was different and apart from all the rest. Paul Sandman did the overnights. He had a special style. He was older than the others, been around a while. He'd segue different album cuts in a stream of consciousness run, do theme sets, live concert tapes. Boy, he made listening fun. No, he must have known my name. He always called me Kid. But he let me watch him work and explain the things he did. And once or twice, he snuck me in the studio late at night and let me cue the tapes and records up to my delight as I wandered back home, bleary-eyed as it was getting light. And while the record spun, he sat and talked of days gone by when radio was younger. So was he, so was I. While round his lonely Kansas farmhouse, snowdrifts blew and curled, the radio was a living color window on the world, he said. There was magic in the radio, enchantment in the ether, a power born of mind and brain and yet a part of neither, a way to take you miles and years by means unknown to science. Nah, but it's since become a jukebox, nothing more than an appliance. I can tell you got the itch, kid. You like to be a jock. Give it up. Magic's gone. There's nothing but the schlock. You deal with all the crazies and the drugged out suicide calls and the sponsors and the FCC have got you by the throat. And programming tells you what to play and they take no denying. You read copy advertising, crap you never think of buying. The hours are long. The pay is squat. Vacations up. But then the cut would end, and he'd face the mic and weave magic once again. Well, sure enough, he read me right. I guess he could recognize a little of his own obsession shining from my eyes. And when I left for school that fall in higher education, my first step was to make a beeline for the radio station. Throughout my freshman year, I learned the ropes and paid my dues. I engineered, did commercials, swept, read the news. By the time I was a sophomore, I'd earned a weekly show. I was on the graveyard shift, but I was on the radio. And I learned Paul Sandman was a name that every DJ knew. The trade rags did a story. He got a piece of Newsweek, too. And sometimes playing album sides from my deserted station, I'd tune in his show on my headphones just for inspiration. And so it was on New Year's Eve of 1969. School's out. They'd all gone home. Station was all mine. Yep, there was I, the rookie jock, left holding down the fort well stocked with day-old pizza pie and coffee by the quart. They had me working triple shift from 8 p.m. to 8, playing records no one listened to while partying till late. And CBS had hooked lines across the country to Times Square. And at midnight, we'd switch over to a live broadcast from there to hear the famous ball come down and ring in the new year. By 11:10, it got so dead, you just could not believe. Who the hell's listening to the radio New Year's Eve? So I queued up Tommy. That would kill a half an hour or so. Kicked off my shoes, plugged in my phones, tuned in the Sandman show. Something's different. Something's wrong. I knew right off the bat. He's playing straight top 40. His voice is sounding flat. There's dead air between his cuts. His spots all in too long. Inside of 15 minutes, I knew something there was wrong. I let him start a record and dialed up his private line. He answered with his call letters, and I replied with mine. Well, hiya, kid. Hey, tell me, ain't you got a better way to spend your New Year's Eve with some busted down DJ? Well, heck no, I'm on the air myself. I got lots of time. I listen to your show because it's better far than mine. But tell me, Sandman, what's with you? Is everything all right? It seems to me as if you're somewhat off your stride tonight. Everything is not all right, he answered with a frown. The Arbitron reports came out, and our ratings have gone down, and Harry Stein in programming has determined that the way to get the ratings back on top is dictate what I play. So here I sit with wrist in hand that says at 10:15 I should play the Righteous Brothers, followed by the Cream, and then some public service spot, and then some Moby Grape. They don't need a DJ to put this crap on tape. It's December 31st. The year is coming to an end, and with it ends a decade, and an era too, my friend. And in 27 minutes, I'll switch over to Times Square. But when I return in 70, you tune in if you care to hear how good the radio could be. If it would tear. He broke off at that point to cue up another platter. I said goodbye. The Who were almost finished for that matter. And exactly 27 minutes later, more or less on cue, I flipped the switch to hook us in with CBS. And while thousands in New York bade fond farewell to 69 and Guy Lombardo in his orchestra played Auld Lang Syne, I raise my slice of pizza and salute to the new year. And once more to the Sandman at the end of his career. When the network show was over with, I went back on mic and did some inane comment about the future of life. Did a station break, queued a record up, and then plugged my headphones in and tuned the Sandman again. Welcome, he began, to 1970 radio. You've noticed in the past a certain blandness to the show. Seems Harry Stein has determined what your music taste should be. Well, you, Mr. Harry Stein. And the FCC, I've had my fill of radio. This here's my final hour, but the door's locked and bolted, and I'm on internal power. And I suppose they'll find a way to get me out eventually. But until then, you'll see how good the radio could be. And then the music started. And the magic came on strong, and how the sequence brought to light a hidden meaning to each song, and where he got those tapes and records, I'll never know. Old favorites I'd forgotten, live recording some show. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. And you can't always get what you want. Where have all the flowers gone? Da-do, run, 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 da-do, run. The Beatles singing German, Dixieland on 78s, Benny Goodman, Walter Carlos, Bessie Smith, the Roommates. This is more than playing records. This is genius. This is art. And this is something all should hear. Damn, I'll do my part. I open the equipment carton, stowed beneath the board, and rummage through the junk there till I find the proper cord, patch headphone out, the preamp in, adjust the input power. And the Sandman show gets relayed out through our antenna tower. I reach out to the telephone, dial WBV8, and it's answered there by Sharon Smith, their overnight DJ. Hey, Sharon, Paul Sandman's just flipped Harry Stein the bird, putting out the best damn radio you've ever heard. And there's a brotherhood amongst the radio voices of the night. They stand behind the fellow jock. They see he's in a fight. Sharon had listened but a moment and then was gone to find a patch cord of her own to send the Sandman on. And then the phones that long I thought were dead began to light as the calls came in from miles around from listeners in the night. Whence comes this wondrous music, they would ask. And I would smile. And how come I pick it up on every station of the dial? And through the night, the signal spread from station onto station as the DJ sent the Sandman and his magic across the nation. Till Sharon called me, laughing, shouting like she was on fire, saying, "Listen! Someone's put the Sandman on the network wire." Well, that's right. The lines to New York were still hooked nationwide. I flipped the switch to listen and laughed until I cried. The Sandman must have reached some hero New York engineer who put him on the wire for the whole damn world to hear. There was magic in the air that night. Enchantments in the ether. A power born of craft and pride. And so much more than either. And all across the country sat the overnight hardcore and shared the Sandman's magic till at 20 after 4 he stopped to say goodbye as they were breaking down the door. New Year's Day dawned cold and gray with just a touch of sleep. Many jock by 9 o'clock found himself on the street. Me? Yeah, I came off cheap. A reprimand is all I got. But New Year's night, a new voice broadcast from the Sandman slot. And since that night, the radio's become my occupation. I'm now a big shot DJ at a major FM station. But when the hours start to drag and the night's going slow, I cue up an album side, crank up my headphone stereo, and tune into the Sandman, now on satellite radio. And when the broadcast room's a living tomb of cracked acoustic tiles, and you're left alone with your microphone and your playlist and your dials, though the airwaves seem a graveyard of lifeless whitened bone, there's always someone listening. And you're really not alone.
Wow. Mike Agranoff with The Ballad of the Sandman. It's an epic poem. I advise all of you. It's amazing how quickly this 2 hours has gone. I have so much more music I wanted to play.
And, me too.
And we're just going to have to do this again one day, Mike, because, goodness gracious, I have a list of songs I was going to play, but unfortunately, we're just about out of time. So I am going to end it, the program.
Well, let me actually just put in a plug. If
sure.
if you folks would want to hear where I'm going to be performing, either online or live when that comes, email me at mike@mikeagranoff.com. And if you aren't misspelling that, talk to Artie. He'll give you the right spelling.
Yeah, absolutely. And exactly. Also your website.
And go to my website, mikeagranoff.com. There are 4 really, really good albums for sale there.
Exactly.
As well.
And that's exactly what I was going to say. If folks want to buy the albums, listen to more of this music, go to Mike's website. Go directly through Mike. Don't go to Spotify or any of those other things.
Right.
Go to Mike and get it through him.
If you stream it from Spotify, I get 0.04 cents.
Wow.
If you buy my album, you get the whole 15 bucks.
Unbelievable. Mike Agranoff, thank you so much for joining me today. We've got to do this again, as I say. I really appreciate your time. And,
this has been a lot of fun.
And
give me a call after sometime when you get home. Let's chat some.
Okay. Mike, thank you.
This is directed to Artie, not to the listeners.
Thanks
actually,
a million.
You guys can call me too, except you don't know my number.
We're going to end the program with The Girl from The Great Divide.
She was tall and dark and slender, and she said that she loved the dance. And there were thoughts unspoken between us, though we dared not take the chance. And we were something more than strangers when the hour of parting arrived. And she headed west to another life. She was bound for the great divide. Word came that she had married, and I wrote her to wish her well. And I swore to profit from my mistake and to heed the tolling bell, that if a girl should capture my fancy, not to let that one slip by. And I raised a glass in a sad salute to the girl from the great divide. Now fruits are for the picking, and I picked till I'd had my fill. But alone I'd find her photograph, stayed with me still till the night at a crowded tavern, as I made ready to play. She walked up to me smiling, and the years just slipped away. Coffee, we spoke of the things we'd done, and she threw back her head in laughter. Oh, it was like she never had gone. And then she spoke about her marriage and the ways of compromise. And I saw how time had touched her face and the sadness around her eyes. We talked the moon down from the sky, and I took her to my home. And I lay pallet down on the floor for her to sleep upon. But in the silence that followed our singing, she came into my arms, and the dawn was sweet and silent, and the morning sun was warm. The sea was calm at sunset as I pressed her to my side. We turned our heads and we looked away, our feelings far too high. Her hands were strong and her lips were soft, in her eyes a smile did pass. The rising tide covered over our steps, and the sand was as smooth as glass. Her dark hair hid her face from me as I saw her to the train that would take her west to her husband, to whom she would explain. She'd decide if she wanted her freedom, and she'd write if she wanted to stay. Now I dream at night of the great divide and her voice so far away. Tall and dark and slender, and she said that she loved the dance.
From his album The Modern Folk Musician, that was Mike Agranoff with The Girl from The Great Divide. Well, the music of Roy and Dale are telling me that it is time to say farewell. I want to thank Mike Agranoff once again, and I also want to thank you for joining me here on this very special episode of Mostly Folk.
Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?